that mind, Syria is calling for some serious action by the UN Security Council to put an end to Israel's illegal practices in the occupied Golan Heights. North Korea questions the sincerity of U.S. offers of talks, saying Washington is overreacting to Pyongyang's missile tests. And also, New Zealand facing a spike in coronavirus infections. The daily case numbers go into three digits for the first time. Hello and welcome, everybody. Syria believes pressure is needed to make Israel stop its violations and illegal constructions in the occupied Golan Heights. The Arab country now wants to see some action from the UN Security Council. Syria's UN envoy says Israeli efforts to change the demographics of the Golan Heights or impose its custody there will fail. Bassam Sabah noted that such measures have no legal effect under the relevant UN resolutions. He says sooner or later the occupied territory will return to Syria. Sabah also condemned Israel for the assassination of a former Syrian lawmaker last week. The Golan Heights belong to Syria and all settlements there are illegal. Israeli officials, however, say they're planning to eventually increase the settler population there fourfold. Group of British lawyers has accused senior officials in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates of complicity in war crimes committed in Yemen. The legal team known as Garnica 37 has filed a complaint with British police calling for the immediate arrest of 22 Saudi and Emirati officials. The human rights lawyers are specifically focusing on two airstrikes in Yemen that have killed more than 160 people, including dozens of children. Reports of torture and murder of civilians by foreign mercenaries have also been cited in the lawsuit. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its Arab allies, launched a devastating war in Yemen in March 2015. The conflict has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Robert Carter, our correspondent who's with us from the British capital, London. Also, we have historian and journalist Brett Yonkers, who's joining us from Hasselt. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Robert in London. Robert, tell us more about the findings of this legal team.
Sure. Well, obviously, it's a much needed challenge, which could potentially be upset between United Kingdom and regional dictatorial regime and its allies there, all of course of whom have been engaged in the horrific crimes taking place in Yemen. Obviously this legal suit is going to the London Metropolitan Police, which are likely to conduct investigations into the claims, and of course that will not be well received in Riyadh or elsewhere, especially at this time because the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss is actually heading over to the Middle East to meet representatives from these regimes in order to talk about things including future trade relations. It's very interesting because the UK is currently at a point where they're looking to improve trade internationally and in particular with their allies. So there's been a lot of talk here in the UK about a possible new trade deal with regimes like Saudi Arabia, for example. However, the World Trade Organization has actually conducted a poll regarding how a trade deal with Saudi Arabia would be received, and it received a shockingly low percentage of support. I can actually give you the statistic. It was just 27% of the public that was asked about it said that they would support a trade deal between the UK and Saudi Arabia. So this would throw an absolute new spanner in the works if this investigation was to be adopted by the police and actually was to escalate further. And also it would bring up a lot of questions surrounding the UK's role in Yemen. For example, the UK selling arms to Saudi Arabia, which has been a deeply contentious issue for years in this country, and could possibly open the floodgates to new lawsuits, new criticisms of the government here. So I'm sure there will be people in 10 Downing Street who will be very, very nervous about this case.
Frank Yonkers, first of all, I'll give us your thoughts on this investigation that has been carried out by the Seagull team. They filed a complaint with British police calling for the immediate arrest of 22 Saudi and Emirati officials. Do you think that, I would say slowly, gradually and effectively, more attention is being brought to the crimes that are being committed against the Yemeni people?
Well, I think this is definitely a very important symbolical gesture that is taken by an official law firm in the United Kingdom. Regardless of whether or not this will actually, in the end, end up with an actual judicial investigation or arrest eventually, I think that chance, unfortunately, remains pretty small because of the geopolitical interests that are at stake here. But the fact, of course, that symbolically speaking, the fact that a law firm, an established law firm that is specialized in international law and the protection of human rights in the UK and worldwide, has decided to start such an official procedure and has filed a complaint with the investigative services in the United Kingdom and with the Metropolitan Police itself, calling for the immediate arrest of the Saudi and Emirati officials if they ever set foot on United Kingdom soil, is a very big step forward in terms of attention given to the fate of Yemen. I think people who have worked on Yemen and have studied Yemen for the past years, this conflict has been going on since 2015, we sigh of relief in a way that finally this is something that comes to mainstream media attention, because now they can't really ignore it anymore. You can't ignore an established official law firm of, you know, British lawyers and judicial experts charging people with war crimes, with torture, with massacring civilians, massacring children, such as the 2018 Dahyan school bus bombing and the 2016 Sana'a funeral hall air bombing, which is what these two incidents that are explicitly mentioned by Guernica 37 in this litigation. So when you see that after so many years of almost complete radio silence, almost complete media silence in the mainstream established media in the West, in Great Britain, in continental Europe, and in the United States, that this has finally come to such an attention that these people have done their work. These lawyers have obviously done their homework. They have really looked into this. They have gathered interviews and information with survivors and with the families and loved ones of those who were murdered in these three incidents that they are specifically mentioning. This by itself is a massive step forward for bringing into attention the things that have been going on in Yemen for so long, and finally breaking through this veil of silence that the mainstream media and the governments in the West have tried to impose on Yemen for so long.
Mr. Yonkers, do you think that the international community, I think it's safe to say that the international community has failed the people of Yemen. Do you agree with that notion?
That the international community, I think, is slowly getting fed up with what the Saudis have been doing, especially since even their mainstream support in the imperial core in the United States and the United Kingdom and other and their European allies has been withering away now, maybe not necessarily amongst the politicians, not necessarily because of how ruthless and how bloodthirsty the Saudis and the Emiratis have shown themselves to be, because everyone kind of knew that already in the circles of power. But they are getting, I think the mainstream support is withering away also because the Saudis have been completely incapable and incompetent in defeating Yemen. They went to war in 2050 with the idea that they would reach Sana'a in weeks, in something that recalls back to the First World War when the British believed they would be home by Christmas. Whereas in reality, we have seen that this war has been dragging on for nearly 7 years now. And instead of the Saudis pulling back the Yemeni revolutionary forces back to Sana'a and beyond, we have seen now recently that we're standing at the brink of the liberation of Ma'arif, which is the last city in central and northern Yemen that is still under Saudi control. When Ma'arif falls to the forces of the National Salvation Government of Sana'a, this would mean that the Saudis and the Emiratis control only a quite thinly populated strip of land at the coast and in Hadramaut in the southeast. So these are areas that are indeed still of strategic importance, but in terms of population, in terms of wealth, they aren't exactly important areas of Yemen to be controlled. And that's why you see the Saudis and the Emiratis now turning against each other. the Saudi-backed forces of the Islam Party of the Muslim Brotherhood are turning against the Emirati-backed southern Yemen separatists. So this conflict has become one big mess in which it is barely possible to discern anymore who is fighting for what cause. Even when they are all backed down in the Saudi, the occupied area, they're all technically part of the Saudi-led coalition, but they're turning on each other and shooting each other just as much as they're turning their weapons against the National Salvation Government and against the forces of Ansar Allah. So when you see all of this happening, this is indeed a strategic moment. And I think that might be also a reason why Guernica 37 has decided to now come out with this procedure. If there is anything that the Saudis are lacking now more than ever, it is popular support worldwide and popular goodwill worldwide. And so now when you come into the media and into the international attention, into the attention of the public opinion with this attack on the school bus of 2018, with this attack on the funeral hall of 2016, things that experts and specialists and people who have, journalists who have been studying Yemen, we already knew this for years, but of course it has remained out of mainstream attention for so long, and now finally it has come to the forefront of Western media, hopefully, and to the forefront of the public opinion and public opinion's attention. I think that's why this is a key moment to hopefully force the United Kingdom, just like so many other European countries have already done, to stop the weapons support to the UAE and to Saudi Arabia,
exactly,
and to stop getting involved in this terrible war against Yemen.
Robert, I'm going to come back to you for final thoughts there. That's exactly where I was going, the issue of military and weapons support to the Saudis. Some of what is happening, the heat has to backfire on London, at least in the court of public opinion, because Britain has been buddy number two, just behind the United States, to the Saudis when we're talking about military support, especially during this war.
Yes, and there is a significant segment of the population which, of course, has solidarity for the Yemeni people. However, we have to bear in mind that Yemen is still the forgotten war. And unfortunately, there are still huge members of Western audiences that just don't really know what's going on there. So we have to bear that in mind, partly because the mainstream media doesn't really report on it enough, partly for the fact that Western governments don't particularly care that much about resolving the conflict there because they're simply profiteering too much from it. But also you have to realize that Saudi Arabia remains deeply unpopular, and so do many of these regimes which engage in the war on Yemen for other reasons. But they're using big money to buy their way back into popularity. So you've seen the Newcastle Football Club takeover in England. That is something where many Newcastle fans, if asked, have admitted that they don't actually care about Saudi Arabia's poor reputation. They just want a wealthy buyer to buy their club and hopefully win a Premier League title. So Saudi Arabia is engaging in tactics to try and basically buy its way back into popular public opinion. I don't think it will work in the long term, and I think ultimately there is far more criticism against the regime for many different reasons, but more work has to be done to highlight why Saudi Arabia and the UAE need to be held to account for the crimes that are happening in Yemen specifically, because they're just so horrific and so hideous and widespread. And hopefully through continued legal pressure, for example, and campaigning, there are a lot of protest actions that take place. Hopefully that will again bring Yemen back into the public eye. But obviously it will require a lot of work from people like us here at Press TV to keep pushing this agenda, because Western mainstream media have clearly shown that they're not interested in doing it, at least not enough.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Robert Carter, a correspondent, joining us from London, and also thanks to historian and journalist Brett Yonkers joining us from Hasselt. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. A hospital in Tehran is offering medical treatment to some of the victims of a deadly terrorist attack that happened in neighboring Afghanistan just days ago. Iran's deputy ambassador has visited the injured at the facility. The official says, following their defeat in Afghanistan, the U.S. and its allies are seeking to use Daesh to cause instability there. He says a recent increase in bomb attacks serves exactly that purpose. He believes regional countries need to redouble their efforts to prevent similar acts of terrorism in the future. At least 60 people were killed and dozens more injured in three back-to-back explosions that tore through a mosque in Kandahar during Friday prayers. Daesh claimed responsibility. North Korea has questioned the sincerity of the United States in its approach toward the country. A North Korean foreign ministry spokesman says Washington's double standards over Pyongyang's missile development casts doubts on its offers of talks. He says U.S. slams the North for testing the same weapons it already has or was developing. The spokesman says Pyongyang's latest missile test is just part of a mid- and long-term plan to bolster the country's self-defense. The official has warned of serious consequences if the U.S. opts for what he calls wrong behavior. The North, on Tuesday, test-fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile. The U.S. called the launch a threat to regional peace and stability. New Zealand is one of the few places in the world known for its success in keeping the coronavirus at bay, but COVID infections there are shooting up, with the daily caseload now a three-digit number. Authorities are reporting 102 new cases, most of them in Auckland. That brings the overall infection since the start to well over 2,200. There have been 28 deaths in total. New Zealand stayed largely virus-free for most of the pandemic until the Delta variant started spreading in August. The tight restrictions on 1.7 million Aucklanders have been extended this week. Officials say infections are likely to rise until vaccination speeds up, urging people to get their shots quickly. Nearly 70% of New Zealanders are fully vaccinated. Close to 90% have received at least one dose. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello
and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves to express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic, lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Lee, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism. And that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that By the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel, because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who've captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets. With, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this, the police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that. That sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil, it's a candlelight vigil, and their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them, and the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also, that Martin Luther King is quoted, yes, as saying, the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak, but then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add
something? I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism. And what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on in this fight.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black people.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
So David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. He's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile as
portrayed in the film? Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. new technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long, and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long as
a brief break now from the discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
It must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like mm-hmm. you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal, yep, 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and,
yeah,
and marginalization, and it's you know, it's that system that's carried on, and people are just now saying we're not going
to
put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have,
yeah,
Donald Trump,
oh, no,
who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that, yeah, the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are trying to look at human rights from the vision and the eyesight of the commander of the faithful Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. We did mention that Amir al-Mu'mineen was trying to build a safe society for people through Islam. The Islamic project to build a safe society in the vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi is represented by several dimensions. That's how Amir al-Mu'mineen looks at them. Perhaps the most important of which are, first, moral and spiritual security, seeking to spread the concept of behavior and piety, because this is the, you know, this is where it all begins, from within us before we move to the outside. And for that, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he says, فَإِنَّ جَارُ اللَّهِ آمِنْ وَعَدُوبُهُ خَائِفٍ. For God's neighbors, I mean the believers, are safe, and His enemies are afraid. So even if we live in a troubled world, even if we live in an unfair, unjust world, if we have that piety, if we have that moral values in us, which Amir al-Mu'mineen, he tries to work so hard on when it comes to educating people, he says, if you have that, it means you have Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on your side. If you have Allah on your side, that will give you a sense of safety, a sense of security, first and foremost. You could be in a prison, you could be, I don't know, under a very dictatorship government or severe ruler. But as long as you have Allah, you're safe. But that won't happen until you try to seek and attain these moral values. So the Imam says, first, human beings, they need to have the right to secure the moral and spiritual aspects of themselves. That's the first thing. So they need to live in an environment where they can actually attain and get these things to feel secure. That's the first thing he says. Second thing that Amir al-Mu'mineen works on after moving from the inner, he moves to the outer, and he says juridical security. We need to live in a world where I know that the court system is fair and just, where I know there are consequences to every action that one does when it comes to stealing and killing and, I don't know, robbing other people and so on and so forth. There has to be a system that guarantees people a fair trial. When it comes to economy, there has to be an economy security. Also from the vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, that needs to be established. Also when it comes to internal and border security of the country itself or the system that you live in, you have to be safe within the borders that you live in. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, even when he looks at, for example, the armies and how he looks at soldiers, for example, he says that it's required. He says they are the soldiers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. فَالْجُنُودِ بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ حُصُونَ الرَّعِيَّةِ. Those who are actually in the correct path, the soldiers who preserve and save the country under an Islamic system, He says they are the soldiers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They're protecting, they become like fortresses for the dwellers of the system, of the people of this country. Now, let us take a break and then inshallah we will continue.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So we said Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah Alayhi, when he looks at even internal and border security, he glorifies the soldiers who try to protect and become fortresses of safety for the people that live in such a system or such a government and an Islamic rule. And he calls them and he refers to them as Junudun bi'idhnillah, soldiers with the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he says, wa'azzuddin, and they are pride and honor for religion. And then he says, wasabilul amn, and they are the way and the path to security. So a system, any system, needs to have soldiers, needs to have military might in order to defeat the foreigners, to defeat foreign armies or those who want to conquer and take over this land. So Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah Alayhi, he keep that into perspective. Again, when it comes to safety and security, when it comes to the Islamic way of trying to build a better society, he even looks at external security and establishments of peace with neighboring countries, for example. And it is also a political goal of Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah Alayhi to have peace with the enemies outside, because you don't want to live in a country where you're constantly threatened by the people around you. He himself says, do not push back a peace that your enemy has called on to you. So sometimes your enemies also, they feel threatened, they call to peace treaty. Come to them, sit with them, and see if you could work something out for the safety and the security of your people. Not to act with arrogance, like we had the First World War, Second World War. Millions of people got killed. Millions of people got displaced, and millions of, refugees and people rights were gone. Why? Just because some countries that were arrogant and they refused, for example, to make peace and come to terms with other nations. So when it comes to Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah Alayhi, that is something that he keeps in his mind. So he says, لَا تَدْفَعَنَّ سُلْحًا دَعَاكَ إِلَيْهِ عَدُوَّكَ. Don't push away a treaty which your enemy has called on to you. And he says, this treaty, that it might have the pleasure and the pleasing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because Allah wants his servants to live in a state of security and in a state of peace. So this is one of the things that Amir al-Mu'minin also looks at when it comes to the human rights. Also, he looks at political and social security. That is something that the human beings need in the Islamic system, of course. So this is the pillars of the Islamic system. We need political and social security that can guarantee that the safety of the human beings that live in such a system as well. So now I had just mentioned the headlines of the system that Amir al-Mu'minin Salamullah Alayhi was trying to establish to people in order to guarantee their safety, to guarantee their security, to guarantee and make sure that their lives are preserved. Their rights are also preserved and given to them. Once these pillars are not there, then the human rights and the human life has no more value anymore. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.